What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear: strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/ohio's time.
Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carbo, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is a former governor of Montana and a highly informed Democratic strategist, Steve Bullock. Remember, we love taking your questions, so write to politicswarroom@gmail.com for next week's show. We're going to get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. You also can get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com. Now, tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And please check out the links to our sponsors, Miracle Made, Delete Me, and Quince, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. You know, James, the president, the defense secretary, and media cheerleaders like Fox News and Eli Lake of the right-wing Free Press all said Iran, a brilliant victory achieved by Trump's genius. So I guess there was unconditional surrender, total regime change, right? Because that's what he said was going to happen. I don't think it quite worked out that way. What they have not told us, 2 weeks of negotiations. Sure, Iran's leaders and military were devastated. There was no regime change, however, as promised. The regime today may be worse than the one before. The abused citizens he was going to come to the rescue in January, they probably are worse off. And Iran, where their missiles have certainly been reduced, their air force and their navy devastated, they have a new weapon that may be far more lethal. They can control the Straits of Hormuz, which, you know, they can either stop shipments or they can charge a fee. And America has depleted some of its armaments. Russia and China have got to feel that they are the big winners in this thing, no matter what happens in the weeks ahead. Everyone should read the New York Times, Maggie Haberman and Jonathan Swan on how Trump went to war, even willing to, you know, commit war crimes. It was careless, it was thoughtless, and he was rolled by Benjamin Netanyahu, who told him you can knock out the regime. And Bibi said maybe the Shah's son, who hasn't been in the country for half a century, could take over Iran. Shades of Shalabi in Iraq. Trump accepted that, even though the military said Bibi usually lies, and Marco Rubio said his claims were bullshit. He's also been rolled by the Saudi dictator MBS. Putin has dominated him, so has Xi Jinping, and for a while, even the little North Korean dictator. You know, we're in the passions of the moment right now about this terrible war. But I'll tell you, I think 2 or 3 years from now, we're going to look back and say we've lost allies. If anything, the region may be more dangerous with Iran knowing they can stop shipments anytime they really want to. I just think this is going to, whatever happens in the next 2 weeks, this is going to turn out to be a disaster.
Well, I think I agree with all of this, but I think the really, really powerful, significant story here is that the Maggie and Jonathan Swain story, everybody is leaking. And by the way, she has a book coming out in June. This is nothing compared to what you're going to see. And I got news for Trump and Pete Hegseth. Everybody around you is leaking. The most secret stuff, they're all calling and telling, and they're all setting themselves up so so history will try to clear it out. It's only beginning. It's only going to get worse. And the commentators that say it's a great Trump victory, it's idiots. And look around. I Trump, you can trust nobody. Nobody. You understand? Pete, you can trust nobody. The walls are closing in on you. People hate you. They're leaking. They're calling people. And you got good reporters like Maggie and Jonathan Swain. By the way, he's a very, very good reporter. I did an event with him a few years ago. And he's got tremendous sources in there. And they all ratting everybody out. This is going to continue to be a hopefully I don't get by too many people killed over it. This is going to be a hugely entertaining story going forward, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, and, you know, the one thing, you know, alliances matter. After 9/11, we counted on alliances. You can't go it alone. We are the world's greatest superpower. We still can't go it alone. And you know something, James, in a year or two or three, if there's a crisis and we call London or we call Paris or we call Berlin or we call even South Korea, we're going to have a lot more trouble getting someone to join us because they can't trust us, because you can't trust him. He lies, and he's lied throughout this. I think over the long run, this is just going to be devastating.
You know, I've always had a little bit of a different view. I will share my view, but certainly yours would be a very legitimate view. I think it's going to get better fast because I think the world is going to just want it to get better. And I think the country's going to want to get better. I think people in the United States and people around the world, particularly in places we've traditionally been aligned with, Canada, Western Europe, places like that, I think they're going to want this situation to have some normalcy to it. Hopefully we get it back. We're not getting it back as long as he's president, I can tell you that.
Well, that's right. I concur totally. But although I think, you know, when we get a Democratic president in 2029, there are going to be several of these countries asking, okay, is this a return to American normalcy? That's what we were told in 2021, and look what happened. And at least it's a question they have to worry about. That's the damage he's done. And I hope you're right. Suspect you are, but it's not as clear cut as it's been.
I hope
it's the end of World War II.
That's it. 2029 is a long way to go.
Oh my God!
A long way to Tipperary or something like that.
Right. If we're doing the podcast in 2029, all you people out there, I want you to say, "Man, you old geezers are really doing something good." Speaking of elections, there were several yesterday. The most prominent being the Georgia race for Marjorie Taylor Greene's seat and the Wisconsin State Supreme Court. There were other local races. And everything I saw was nothing but good news, again, for Democrats. CNN's Harry Enten, I've become a Harry Enten fan. He is as insightful as he is entertaining. He found Democrats were running not only double digits better than Harris's performance in 24, but that increase... The increase over this, the special elections over the last presidential election was much bigger than it was in 2018 when Democrats won a landslide victory in the House. Wisconsin Republicans just threw in the towel, and that Supreme Court majority that Democrats hold is going to be there in 2030. That means they will protect against the Trump and efforts to steal. And in that suburban county, elected a heavily Republican county, elected a Republican mayor. And in Georgia, he got what the general, who was a Democratic candidate, got 44%. That was what, James? 13 points, 14 points better than Harris?
No, 31 and 4. But Trump carried a district by 37. The Democrats lost it by 12. You can do the math.
Right.
That's big. I think it's 25. But this is what Democrats have to conclude. You have to say situational awareness. What's the situation right now? We're winning everything. You made one little misstep. You said that suburban, the W County elected a Republican mayor. It was a Democratic mayor. I know that's what you meant.
They nominated a left winger for that seat. Right.
But so you ask yourself, here we are, early April of election year. What's more likely to happen when people start voting in October on through election day? Will the situation be the same? Will it be about where we are? Will Trump get more popular and Republicans do somewhat better than they're doing today, or will it even get worse? I actually think the logical play here is you play where the ball is going to be, not where the ball is. I think it's going to get worse for them. And what I'm advocating and what I'm doing myself, I'm spending my time and my energy on Senate races. We're going to win the House, okay? I'm making these assumptions. We're going to win the House, and we're not going to have much trouble in places like North Carolina or Georgia to hold a seat. There, things could go haywire in Michigan, and we could talk about that at a later date, maybe. But for the most part, I'm in third-tier Senate races, South Carolina, Florida, Mississippi, Texas, because I think that we're on the verge of having, we're on the verge of having a particularly good year. It's more like they're on the verge of having a really catastrophic year. And we ought to play hard into that. Not where it is, and it's in a very good place, but I think it's just going to get better.
Mm-hmm. Well, all right, you focus there, which is really, really good, and I'm going to focus out west.
Okay.
I'm going to focus on Alaska and Montana and Iowa, all of which, under certain circumstances, can and should be winnable.
Well, I'm
calling my Senate races.
We're going to talk to Governor Bullock in the show.
Right.
I will put another one that might slightly be in play. You ready? Drum roll,
yep.
Please. Idaho. They actually have coming up with a really good candidate who's going to run as an independent. The same thing that's happening in Montana. But we can explore it.
I think in Nebraska also, right, James?
Yeah, we got that debt. Yes.
Osborne, right.
This might be the new trend in politics, particularly west of the Mississippi, that the idiots, the identity idiots, have so tarnished the party brand that people are just going to run as independents and do what Angus King does, which is completely fine with me, by the way. Bernie Sanders, caucus with the Democrats. I'd much rather have an independent that caucus with the Democrats than a right-wing Republican. And
no question.
Maybe the brand is in that shape where they have to do that. I'm not embarrassed by it. I'm like, man, do what you got to do, win the goddamn election.
Well, Tom Edsel, as always, has a couple of good pieces in the New York Times. And what Tom says in talking to his people, that may, and I think he's right, that may well be a good short-term solution and the sort of places you mentioned. But what you hope long-term is that Democrats can improve that brand, which has been wrecked by a number of things, the left-wing cultural elitist, Joe Biden and others. But, you know, as a way station, whether it's Montana or Idaho or Nebraska, if you can elect a Angus King type independent, go for it.
Absolutely.
James, final subject. J.D. Vance, that great shapeshifter, is out there on the campaign hustings, really forcefully campaigning for a candidate. That candidate is not in Wisconsin or is not in Montana or is not in Texas or North Carolina. That candidate is in Hungary. Viktor Orban, the pro-Putin, autocratic, corrupt leader of Hungary, who is down in the polls, and who is over there helping him but J.D. Vance. I think it's going to actually be counterproductive, but it's also outrageous.
Yeah, I guess it's outrageous. I also guess at some level it's humorous. And if you notice in the stories that Vance is saying, I told Trump that I disagreed with the Iran war, but that if he did it, I would be for it. This is a man that's trying to cover his tracks to run for president. And if he thinks the MAGA people or what's left of them don't notice that, or thinks other people don't notice that, he's playing everybody for a fool. And the fact that they're getting crap knocked out of them in places like Georgia and Wisconsin and losing wild county mayors, and he's in Budapest doing his thing, it just adds to not the odiousness of J.D. Vance, because he can't be any more odious than he is, but it just adds to the clownish aspect of J.D. Vance's politics.
Yeah, no, it does. You know, it certainly does. I mean, James, talking about changing, how many times has he changed his name? I mean, I think he's changed his name 3 or 4 times. If you're going to change your name, I guess you can change your positions, right?
You know, that guy just strikes me as somebody that probably got dropped on his head when he was a kid or something. There's something wrong with that boy. I mean, really wrong with it. Sleep cool and clean with Miracle Sheet. Well, let me remind you that it's April and it's springtime. And you know what follows springtime? Summertime. And I don't know what else to say, but I think we can all agree the summers are getting hotter. In some places, much hotter. And you got to sleep in the summertime. You got to sleep in the wintertime. And the sheets that you sleep on are going to determine what kind of night's sleep. And boy, this is something that's going to help, particularly in you know, places like I live, like Louisiana, but more the country, climate-wise, is coming close, more like being Louisiana than maybe anywhere else in the country.
Yeah. So, you know, if you wake up sweaty, freezing, or just uncomfortable, take it from James. It's time to upgrade. The temperature in your bedroom can make or break your sleep. That's why you need to switch to Miracle-Made sheets. They're inspired by NASA technology and use silver-infused temperature-regulating fabric to help you sleep perfectly all night long. Sleeping at the right temperature is a critical way to feel rested the next day. And whether it's too hot, too cold, Miracle-Made sheets truly give you maximum comfort in any weather. They make pillowcases and comforters also. Plus, thanks to their antibacterial silver technology, Miracle sheets require way less laundry days because they stay clean and fresh 3 times longer. Not only is that fewer wash cycles, but it's great for your skin. Hidden bacteria can clog your pores and cause acne. So sleep cleaner and clearer with Miracle. With no more gross odors, life is a whole lot better for your household. Join us in getting better sleep every night. Not only are Miracle-Made sheets smooth, breathable, and ridiculously comfortable, they don't have the steep price tag of other luxury brands. Miracle sheets feel nicer than bed sheets used by some 5-star hotels. So it's a vacation when you get into bed. I imagine myself in Tuscany, but it's your call. Drift off to dreamland and wake up at the perfect temperature every time you get into bed. Choose Miracle to upgrade your sleep or give the gift of better rest. Go to trymiracle.com/warroom to try Miracle-Made sheets today. You'll save over 40%. And when you use the promo code warroom, you'll get an extra 20% off, plus a free 3-piece towel set. They make an amazing gift, and with a 30-day money-back guarantee, there's no risk. That's trymiracle.com/warroom with the code warroom at checkout. Thanks to Miracle for sponsoring this episode. The link also is in our show notes. Hey, James, our guest is Steve Bullock, who was a very successful 2-term governor of Montana, remains an important voice in the Democratic Party, and co-owner of Brothers Brewery in Helena. Now, if you pronounce it correctly and you tell them you heard him on Politics War Room, stop by. You might even get a free beer. Governor, Governor, it is terrific to have you on today. Let me just start off by asking you, how do you think Trump's actions on Iran are playing in general and in Montana specifically?
Look, I think in general, you look at them by and large, and folks' lives aren't getting better. I mean, when gas is over $4 a gallon, a lot of folks were supporting him because they're like, enough of these forever wars. So I think he thought he'd have the same thing as Venezuela. And when it's not turning out that way, when people's lives aren't actually getting better, when the costs continue to increase, you know, this is just one more thing where folks are saying, what I thought I'd get, I'm not getting from him.
Yeah, no, I mean, all he does is claim victory, and all indications are he certainly didn't achieve what he said he was going to achieve: regime change, total surrender, and all that kind of stuff. Let me turn to politics. In the red states, which you know well, living in one and having represented one for a long time, there seems to be what would strike me this year as a political dichotomy. Everything points to a possible Democratic wave in the midterms. Republicans say, however, that Trump remains solid with his base. Can you square those two in a state like Montana?
Well, I think, look, in a state like Montana, a lot of other places, that at times what works on the coast and sort of the national definitions don't work quite as well for there. Like, you know, that I am a proud Democrat, but I'm a proud Democrat that says, you know, everybody should have a fair shot. Working folks actually need to have that fair shot. And there are times where it sounds to a lot of folks that that's not what the Democrats are fighting for. His popularity is dipping. Trump's in a whole lot of areas. And I think that it will be a great midterm election, but we have to make sure that we're expanding the map and looking at folks in Montana as well as East Coast or Georgia and other places.
What are the big, I mean, when people perceive the Democratic Party as being out of touch, as being whatever have you, what are the particulars of the perceptions, correct or not?
I think, look, the promise is you work hard, you play by the rules, you're going to do better, right? And that's always been sort of the bedrock of also what the Democrats are fighting for. But right now, I think the perception is that we care a lot more about social issues than we do about those pocketbook issues. And we have to make sure that, look, Trump helps set it up, right? That the folks that will be cleaning the rooms of a hotel are actually paying more in taxes than a whole lot of the largest companies in the country. You look at healthcare. What's going to happen after this big, beautiful bill is a whole lot more folks are going to be cut. And when you're focusing on those issues that people are talking about across a fence line or around their kitchen table or at the bar, I think that's how we win.
The politics in Montana this year are fascinating. You have one candidate who's declared as an independent with extraordinary credentials, Seth Bodner, president of the University of Montana, first in the class at West Point, Rhodes Scholar, Green Beret Commander, GE Executive, running as an independent, probably for some of the reasons you just cited. Yet, if the Democrats nominate, they will nominate a candidate in June, doesn't a three-way race really assure the Republicans would win?
Two things, Al. First of all, look, the Western District congressional race, Democrats will and should retake it. It's close enough. It's, I don't know, R+3, R+4 district, but we have strong candidates going into June. And for that House race, I think there's a real good shot that actually Democrats take it. It used to be held by Congressman Zinke. He's no longer running again. To your question, though, look, the hope is with an independent and a Democrat that come maybe August, September, folks say the most important thing is making sure that that Republican does not hold the Senate seat. And at that point, there may be a way through it. But Seth is a very impressive guy. I've known him since he became president of the University of Montana, and he's out working hard. We'll have to see between now and late fall sort of what things look like in Montana.
Yeah.
But I certainly wouldn't write it off.
The retiring Republican incumbent, Steve Daines, pulled a fast one, didn't he, when he bailed out? Tell us about that.
So 5 minutes before the close of filing, Steve Daines, who had already filed, dropped out, and someone new, a guy named Kurt Almy, who U.S. attorney, known the guy since high school, filed. Dane said, the reason why I did that is to make sure that like John Tester or Steve Bullock doesn't end up filing. But I think what it's done, and even to step back a little bit, a year and a half ago, state legislature changed the law. So for a write-in candidate, like let's say you're going to the ballot and you say, I want Al Hunt as my senator. Al Hunt would have had to file at the same time that other candidates did in March. So essentially eliminating write-in possibilities. There's a lot of Republicans in Montana that are mad about that. Like we don't appoint kings. Like, you know, there shouldn't be these shady backroom deals. There was a guy, he'd run for statewide office, held the office of Secretary of State, Brad Johnson, lifelong Republican, who just did an op-ed yesterday that said, I've known Steve Daines since I think it was college or even high school. And this is not, you know, we don't choose people in backroom deals. And Republicans are really upset about it as well.
James Carville.
So, Governor, you're one of the most successful red state politicians in a long time. I would put you and Governor Laura Kelly of Kansas right up there. Having run in a red state with the Democratic brand, did you find it more of a brand to run on or a brand to run from?
So, look, I think I first got elected in 2008. I think the Democratic brand has even changed in some respects from that time to today. But what I would try to do is make it about, you know, I would begin with a base assumption that most people's lives are too hectic or busy to care about politics, that they're more worried about, is my car going to break down? Is my kid going to get sick? But we shared values. Like, everybody wants a safe community, a roof over their head, a decent job that actually leaves a little at the end of the month, clean air, clean water, good public schools, a belief you can do better for your kids and grandkids than you did for yourself. And if we talked about those values, so that's what I would be talking about more of the values than here's what the Democratic Party is talking about. I'd say, how can we make it relevant to your life? Now, I say things may have changed even since I got into it. You know, in 2016, I made the mistake of saying, after I'd gotten reelected, when Trump won by 21, I won by 4. So almost a third of my voters also voted for Donald Trump. I'd said at that time, look, I wish people cared about politics and public policy as much as they do about, like, professional football, right? On any given Sunday, not only are the stadiums full, but millions watching it. Now, in some ways, unfortunately, I think we care about politics the same way that we care about professional sports. You're a Raiders fan. Not only do I not like you, I don't like your kids. And it's become sort of this red team, blue team, to the point where Montana has always been a state where I said we're libertarians and gave a damn about our neighbors. Like, you know, we don't trust government. That's okay. But we cared about community. And we're losing some of that by just the polarization in, not just in Montana, but around the country.
So by way of disclosure, we're at the same conference, Governor Bullock, at American Press Conference right now. And you mentioned a state that, frankly, I hear very little about, and it took me aback. And the state you mentioned was Idaho. That's right, Idaho. And tell our listeners in the context that you mentioned Idaho, and why on earth would any Democrat or anybody be talking about Idaho right now? Other than it's a beautiful state, nice people, but generally not the top tier in discussion of politics.
No, James, I think it's worth looking at. It has some of the same dynamics as Montana, in as much as a relatively young guy named Todd Achilles is running for Senate as an independent. He's run against James Risch, who's deeply unpopular in Idaho. And I think he's had over 100 town halls across the state. And he's talking about the issues that matter to folks. So sort of like in Montana, like, if we get all that figured out, I think it could be a competitive race. They need to figure it out between their party's primaries are in May for the Democrat. I haven't followed that closely, but I've seen what Todd's doing in Idaho, and he's working damn hard, and he's run against a deeply unpopular senator there. So, you know, we look at all the ways, and James has talked a lot about it, and I now believe, like, Mississippi can be won. Like, we need to figure out where all we can expand the map. And I wouldn't write off places like Idaho or Montana right now. There's 205 days between now and the election, and a lot can happen.
So, as I understand it, to restate the problem, there's going to be a Democratic nominee in Montana, be chosen June 4th, did you say?
Yeah, right around there, first week of June.
Be a Democratic nominee in Idaho. Now, both independent candidates have said they, like Angus King, would caucus with Democrats. how can we Democrats around the country, and I think we have a shot, how can we encourage these people to drop out and leave the field open for an independent who caucus or Democrats? Because if the Democrat wins, you know the math, okay? Could viewers or listeners write letters asking you to think about the country at large? I don't know how do we proceed from here?
Yeah, it's a tough statement to make, James, because look, if you invest the time and energy to run for office,
right,
you know, that you're doing it because you truly, truly believe not only that you have a shot, but you can make things better. So I'm not sure that outside pressure on either of the nominees is going to be what moves it. But hopefully folks turn around and say, who's going to have the best shot and beat Idaho or Montana if come August, it looks like the Democrat would have the best shot? I would hope the independent would drop out. If it looks like the independent's going to have the best shot, then I think there's discussions to be had, but I'm not sure that sort of national pressure works that well on individual candidates, because I have great respect for anybody that puts their name on the ballot and travels all around the state. And that's something that they would have to come to, not us coming to, I think.
What I'm sort of calling for is maybe, hey, I'm Aggie from Sheboygan, or I'm Billy from Billings, and I would ask you to please consider it. Maybe you could just do it in a heartfelt way that, hey, we have an outside chance to really change the direction of this country. I just hope that you would be not, if you do this, your political career is over, you'll never do anything. I don't think that works, but maybe we could, you know, use the carrot a lot more to stick here. But we got to try to get these people lined up one-on-one where we have a chance in a state that we never, ever thought we could possibly have a chance.
And I agree. Heavy-handedness does not work. But I think that there is, you know, we're all looking at this, and even where Al started with Iran, a lot's changed in the last 3 weeks. There's a lot of time there. And between now and the election. And I think that encouragement of like, let's make sure that we can win this state, whoever it is a good way to go.
So one more question before I turn it over to Al. I know about Montana geography. Eastern Montana is pretty sparsely populated, but is very agrarian, produce a lot of crops. Do you have any sense in talking to people that some of these farmers are starting to question their support for Trump? I mean, given tariffs, immigration policy, energy prices, which I think clobber farmers more than maybe any other sector, because they really depend, they really consume a lot of fuel. Is there any evidence of a pushback there that you see?
You know, James, on the one hand, I see a lot fewer Trump flags. Which ought to mean something. Like, you can never tell people they voted wrong, right? That's not going to be what persuades them.
Yeah.
And you know that as well or better than anyone. But I do see folks turn around and saying, look, everything that I thought I was supporting, I ain't getting, and my life ain't getting better. So that's, you know, individuals that they're not going to turn around and say, the first thing I want to do is vote for Democrat, but all of a sudden they're not too excited about what's happening here. And I think it presents great opportunities all across the country.
Good. Albert?
I can't resist this. The last Democratic senator from Idaho was Frank Church. And when Frank Church, this is a wonderful story from our dear friend, the late Mark Shields. When Frank Church ran for president in 1976, he put out a comprehensive, candid medical report which said he had once had a testicle removed. And Mark Shields said he's got a great campaign slogan: "Vote for Church. He's got ball." Anyway, it didn't work. Steve, what I'm thinking of these cultural issues, and one of them, which frankly pains me, but I think Republicans have demagogued and capitalized on, is the question of transgender rights and transgender playing in male sports. I think it's, you know, Lord, these people have a very, very difficult life. There ought to be protections and everything else. But I think on some of those issues, politically, it's just not worth it. And when I find people like Gavin Newsom or Rob Sand, who's running for governor in Iowa, or Martina Navratilova say, look, we ought to simply say that people who are born as men should not play in women's sports. You know, that's it. That makes sense to me. How about you?
Yeah, I think that, look, there's, you know, I mean, USA Facts estimates 2.1 trillion folks in America that identify as transgender. They should have every single protection that you and I have.
Yes.
But we also have 5.6 million people that are unbanked. We have 1.6 million people that are Walmart workers. We have 3.4 million people that are farmers or ranchers. And folks are like, are we actually fighting and making sure their lives are better as well? And I think that's part of what we need to do. And we have to say that, yeah, folks ought to have every protection, but I don't disagree with you, Al. Like, there are some issues, like in sports, gender identity, that I sure wish we were fighting more for the 5.6 million people that are unbanked, that literally don't have a bank account, and that folks knew the Democrats are fighting for those 1.6 million Walmart workers as well. And sometimes that message gets lost.
Yeah, it does. And it is pure demagoguery, but it seems to me it's a simple answer. Was you, this is one you're going to duck, I suspect. When you look over the field of people who are talking about running in 28, is there anyone who's delivering the kind of message that you'd like to hear from Democrats?
Look, I think the one thing that we saw through these midterms, Al, was be it Spanberger, be it Mikey Sherrill, be it even Mamdani, they were talking about issues that impact people's lives, cost issues. Is life actually getting easier for me? Do I have health care? As we focus on those things going forward, I think that, and I sure as hell hope the 2028 field, that's what they're principally focusing on, is how can we actually make sure that people have a fair shot at the American dream? There's a lot of time between now and then, so I'm not ducking it. It's more that those pocketbook issues got to be a big part of what Democrats, whoever our nominee is talking about.
Yeah. James.
So the Olympic Committee just did, I think, a huge favor. They came out with the tests you do to determine if you run as a female in women's sports or men's sports. I think the Democratic platform in 2028 should say we should adapt the Olympic standard when it comes to high school sports. I think the Olympics know more about competition than we do, and just adapt that standard and give protection to transgender people, to any other people should be protected. But I think they gave us a great out, and you don't need to concern yourself with it anymore.
I think that's fair, James. And I also think, though, that often it's us talking about it now even more than, you know, when you're out there talking to that farmer that Alf talks about, like, that's not his biggest concern. But as the Olympic Committee did it, as NCAA is doing it, like, that, this is where we are, and that makes sense to me.
Yeah, come on, people. Yeah. We can do this. We got the standards, but... All right, well, Governor, I want to thank you personally. You're a dear friend. You really bring a lot of, not just common sense, you know, real sense to the table. Successful two-term governor in a state that rarely elects Democrats, but I think we have a real shot if we're smart for a Senate seat in Montana that no one else has figured on. And I dare say I never thought we'd be mentioning the state of Idaho in this podcast, but Idaho, we love you. And if you can do an independent that caucus with Democrats, they'll love you even more.
And James, now, the next time we do this podcast, let's do it from my tap house in Helena, Montana. So,
oh, wow.
In the summertime.
Absolutely. We've been talking about that for a long time. We actually have to do it. So it's both a brewery and a tap house, right? Or together?
It's 40 different handles. We actually buy the beer from other places. We don't brew it. But but it would be great to have you guys there. We just did something a couple weeks ago with John Tester and Mark Roscoe, who's the former RNC chair, where the three of us were talking about sort of where we are and what we need to be doing. And so it's a great place to have community conversations. And hell, I'd even buy you guys your first two beers.
Can you pour me a good craft-made local Montana lager? You got a couple on that 40 pools?
with 40 handles, James, I can pour you all kinds of good ones.
We can't wait.
Gee, speaking, you know, we can, James, we can try to shake down John Hickenlooper, too, and have a bidding contest because, he runs a craft beer place in that. But I would love to come to Montana. So, Carville, let's us both push each other to do that. Governor, you've been a terrific guest. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Great seeing you both.
All right. Go Idaho. Protect yourself online with DeleteMe. I mean, you can just look and see that people all over the world are trying to hack your personal data and trying to do anything they can, but in addition to selling it and everything else. I mean, I guess I would ask how important it is that you lock your car. It's very important.
Yeah. You know, DeleteMe makes it easy, quick, and safe to remove your personal data online at a time when surveillance and data breaches are common enough to make everyone vulnerable. With DeleteMe, you can protect your personal privacy or the privacy of your business from doxing attacks before sensitive information can be exploited. That's huge, because in 2026, it's easier than ever to find personal information about people online, having your address, phone number, and family members' names hanging out on the internet can have actual consequences in the real world and put all of them at risk. As public figures, we always knew we could be targets for scammers and worse. When we found out how many Americans are compromised and at the mercy of criminals, we wanted to fight back. With DeleteMe, you'll feel so much better about your security. But more importantly, as family men, we know DeleteMe is something that can help keep our loved ones safe. So join us and refuse to be a victim. Start taking steps to protect your privacy with DeleteMe. The New York Times Wirecutter has named DeleteMe their top pick for data removal services for a reason. So don't wait. Take control of your data and keep your private life private. By signing up for DeleteMe, now at a special discount for our listeners, get 20% off your DeleteMe plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/warroom and use the promo code warroom at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/warroom and enter the code warroom at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/warroom, code warroom. The link is also in our show notes. If you thought the departure of Pam Bondi might mean a more honest and reasonable Department of Justice, think again. Todd Blanche, the deputy there, is a Trump hatchet man. He'll do whatever Trump asks him to do. He was Trump's personal lawyer. The latest revelation is that they're going to bring action against Cassidy Hutchison, now a 29-year-old former Trump White House aide. I guess she was, 25 then, who testified before the January 6th committee about what happened on that day, that awful, terrible day of infamy. She described details as she remembered them. I suspect 95% of them were right, and maybe she got one or two things wrong. The Justice Department, I think even the Civil Rights Division, is now threatening to indict her. I mean, this is just Trump saying anybody who had anything to do with January 6th, anyone who tried to tell the truth, anyone who tried to express the outrage about what happened. Remember, Todd Blanche just bragged that he had fired all the FBI agents and secretaries and anybody involved in that. Anybody who was implicated in this in any way, and really are basically an honest innocent like Cassidy Hutchinson, they're going after. You know, Todd Blanche may be worse than Pam Bondi. Yeah, I can understand why J.D. Vance loves Hungary. This is a Justice Department that would be well suited for a place like Hungary or maybe even Russia.
So, thank you. My outrage is somewhat of an outrage, but more an observation. I'm coming to you from Boston at an American Bridge conference, and I just was on a panel with Molly Murphy, moderated by Brandon Baychuk, David Wasserman, myself. And Molly said, I think, the most important thing I've heard in the cycle. She said, people come up to me and ask me, is it good that the Democrats are winning this election? She said, you know what they are? They're all Democrats. It's a good thing we're winning. How about that? The Democratic mentality, the Democratic campaign mentality, the overwhelming pessimism and defeatism causes Democrats to say, well, is it really a good idea that we win in elections? Now, think about that for a second. And I just did Rick Wilson's show. And Rick and all of the other people, I want to try to get them together at a bridge, a Democratic event, to explain what it's like to have been a Republican consultant all your life and then enter this idiotic culture of Democratic campaigns that defeatism, pessimism, utter lack of faith in the judgment of people is the dominant dynamic in the past in Democratic consulting and advice. And I'm going to try to bring these guys in because Rick, he says the same thing that Stewart says or Crystal or any of these guys. You're not near mean enough. This is a wimpy culture. It's always been defeatist. And I think we have a chance to try to do everything I can to change Democratic campaign culture. And of course, when you say something, which I did, and people, not as I knew they would, they went nuts, but no one questioned it anymore. When I said our culture's just become too overly feminized, by that I meant we're too much looking for another way, are we too much understanding, are we too much this or that. Not some of the toughest politicians I've ever known have been female politicians. Don't kid yourself. Some of the best consultants I've ever known have been female consultants, but that culture is not what in the past was dominating Democratic campaign culture. And we have a chance to change that culture come this November. And I'm going to do everything I can to try to do that. Is it good that we're in an election? Yes, it's good.
James, about 50 years ago, more than 50 years ago, I interviewed New York Congresswoman Bella Abzug. First time I interviewed her, I asked her a question. Wasn't a very important question, I don't think, because I remember it. I asked the question, she looked at me and she said, bullshit, bullshit. And I thought, okay, that's, you know, if that's the feminization of the Democratic Party, we need more of it.
Yeah, I'm talking about people like Elizabeth Slotkin or Tammy Baldwin, people like this.
Right.
Survivors. I'm not. Understand some of the best. I look at some of the you know, like Mandy Grunwald, Molly, or people, Alyssa Hogan, people like that, that are in Democratic culture, that are anything that just the opposite of what I'm talking about. I probably need to come up with a better word, but this culture is too pessimistic and too defeatist for my good. And by the way, as these Republicans are coming aboard, they're all looking at me like Mike Murphy looks at me and, James, what is wrong with these people? I said, shit, welcome to my life for the last 40 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Get your style right with Quince. Well, first of all, you get two words, stylish and affordable. And affordable, you can see when you look at the price of it. It's really stylish, and more than anything else, is very well made.
Yeah, it really is. And at this time of the year, it always makes us rethink what's in our closet. And with spring cleaning in full swing, we're all trying to keep fewer things but better ones. That means upgrading our style with pieces that are well made and easy to wear all the time. That's why we keep coming back to Quince. The fabrics feel elevated, the fits are thoughtful, and the pricing actually makes sense. If you haven't heard, Quince makes high-quality everyday essentials using premium materials like 100% European linen, and their insanely soft, flow-knit, active-wear fabric. Their men's linen pants and shirts are lightweight, breathable, and comfortable, which makes them the perfect layer for spring. The pants strike the right balance between laid-back and refined, so you look put together without trying too hard, especially if you're running around town or getting your steps in. The flow-knit activewear is a must. It's moisture-wicking, anti-odor, and soft enough that you'll actually want to wear it all day. Best of all, everything from Quince delivers affordability and quality. Incredibly, their prices are 50 to 60% less than similar brands. How do they do that? Quince works directly with the ethical factories and cuts out the middlemen. So you're paying for quality, not brand markup. Everything is designed to last and make getting dressed easy. The fits are perfect, the fabrics are incredible, and the style and options are unmatched. You should take a look at James Carville in that cashmere sweater. And a Quince favorite in our family is a luxurious stretch wool dress pant. They feel amazing and are perfect for business on the hill, meeting a source, or reading on a recliner in style. So upgrade your everyday essentials with fewer pieces and better materials by refreshing your wardrobe with Quince. Go to quince.com/warroom for free shipping and 365-day returns. We also have some good news. Quince is now available in Canada, too. Go to quince.com/warroom for free shipping and 365-day returns. Again, quince.com/warroom. The link is also in our show notes. Now for our listener questions. James Terry in Lakeville, Minnesota, asks, why don't retiring members of Congress vote against Trump? What type of retribution does he have on? What type of dirt? I mean, there are record numbers of retirees in the House, and very few of them are running for other office. So why don't they feel free to vote of conscience if they have one?
You know, it's a good question. Maybe some of them are just retiring for the reason stated, certainly not a lot of them. And, you know, somebody's running to replace him, and they feel like if they said something, then that would put their favorite designated successor in a tight bind. The best answer I can come up with. But clearly, when history is written, the people that went along with this and tried to get both sides of it sound really ridiculous. I was listening to this guy, Mike Lawler, who I've never seen a politician who so desperately wanted it both ways. And he's going to lose, and he richly deserves to lose.
He's running against a great candidate.
At least he's putting his name out there so people can actually vote against him. So I'll give him credit for that.
Yeah, James, I would add also some of these...
No, I think Mike Lawler is his name. It's not Tom Hall.
It is Mike Lawler. Some of these retirees want to be lobbyists. And that may factor into how they behave in the last. That could be a mistake, too, with the Democrats winning the House. This is just a great town. I lived in Massachusetts. I've never heard of this, but Corleen in Feeding Hills, Massachusetts. Feeding Hills. I got to find out where Feeding Hills is. She said, it looks like Trump wants to take us out of NATO. Could he succeed, or are there enough safeguards in place? He can't succeed in taking us out, Corleen. It would require a two-thirds vote of Congress to do that. That won't happen. What he'll try to do as long as he's in office is just tarnish, gut, pull troops, pull funding, do everything he can to weaken NATO. But he cannot pull us out, and hopefully that may be one of the areas that after this disastrous presidency is over, can be rebuilt.
Yeah, I hope so. You keep coming back to the same thing. What does Putin have on him? It's the only explanation for this. And I suspect that we're going to find out before his term is up. I really do. Too many people see this, and there's just, it just explains so much.
No, it sure does. James, Jim in St. Augustine, Florida, I do know St. Augustine, Florida, said, assuming that ICE will be at polling locations in the midterm elections, how should voters handle this? My biggest concern, Jim's biggest concern, is that ICE will have preemptively gotten a conservative judge to give them permission to seize ballots or machines the minute the polls close. Is that a real concern? What should we do about it?
I would certainly not say it's not a frivolous concern. But what I would say, this is much harder to do than it seems like. So the theory of being that they would target some voting places, I can't imagine all but a few really right-wing judges, you couldn't get an injunction stopping this and couldn't do it pretty quickly. I am confident that we're getting putting together a good legal team. And by the way, it's not just a good Washington legal team. We need a good legal team that can respond on the spot in different places around the country. I think we're going to do this. It is something to worry about, but it is much harder to pull off than people would have you think.
No, I think you're right, but I think we both agree we really need a top-notch legal team. We need a team like the Biden team had after 2020, the Seth Waxmans, the Don Varillas. You can't go with a B team because they're gonna cheat every way they can, and they have the Justice Department with them. And you also have to have great local attorneys. But there's some people say, well, this is just a state, you know, elections are state and local, so we don't have to worry about a team coming out of Washington. Yeah, we do. We need to have both because what they tried to do in 2020 was awful. It'll be kids' play compared to what they're going to try to do this year.
It's something to be concerned about. It's much harder to pull off. And it's really hard to pull off when people are aware that it might happen. Just do that and win the election.
Sue in Cumberland, Rhode Island, and Jack in San Diego, California, talking about the late Stephen Hawking felt that robots are more reliable than humans. Can we replace Trump with Claude? Do you think we'll ever see an AI candidate or platform? You know, I'm just, you know, a bunch of us have this wonderful AU student who's trying to teach us AI. It's slow, James. Let me just say, it's really, really slow. But Congressman Don Beyer has probably spent more time on this than anybody in the House and has a full-scale proposal. It could be transformative. There are smart people who say it'll be bigger than the internet. And I noticed that Sam Altman put out a series of proposals, some of which he may have done defensively because there's a big New Yorker piece on him. But, you know, you can't. I had a rare disagreement with one of our guests a few weeks ago. There has to be some kind of guardrails. If it's going to be transformative and it's going to mean millions of jobs will change or be lost, there has to be some kind of guardrail set up. You don't want to stifle innovation, but at the same time, you don't want just the Silicon Valley people to get rich while everybody else suffers. So I don't know very much about it, but I accept the fact it's going to have profound implications and we better be ready for it.
So I think one thing that's really significant is that this vote, where was it last night? Well, I think it was Wisconsin. They voted down this AI center and not by a little bit. You know, where they're building these huge data processing centers. I see that all over the country. And I think what's in people's mind is not that, is it going to work? I think people say, yeah, I'm scared it's going to work really well. And just like everything else that comes along, it's going to work against me. And people are highly concerned about it. Now, in terms of regulating AI, yes, but what people would say, what do they call it? Regulatory capture. It's, you know, we've regulated the internet somewhat. Well, look what happened. How do you regulate? I don't know. I don't know the answers to this.
I don't either.
But I know this shit is coming. And I know people for good reason don't trust that it's going to be beneficial to them. So
We got to let it unfold. But boy, there's distrust in this country for this like massive technological power that people have since thrown out.
No, it really is. I mean, it could be transformative in a very good way, and it could be transformative in a very, very worrisome way. And there have to be some kind of guardrails. James, Mike in Uncasville, Connecticut, which I suppose is next to Cassville, Connecticut. But anyway, from Uncasville, Mike asks, since Democrats will certainly flip the House in the midterms, what should be investigated first? There are too many crimes to investigate them all. What should the House focus on? What should the priorities be? Good question, James.
What a great question. This has got to go in the question hall of fame. And the answer is simple. The corruption. Start a program to get clawbacks, to not only isolate, identify, and inform of the corruption, but to start action to get this money back where it belongs in the Treasury of the United States. And by doing that, and you understand, the hardest thing to do in politics is to remember this. To focus on one thing means you're not focusing on another thing. So you say, by your total focus on corruption, you're not focusing on the how ignorant and stupid and jackass the cabinet is, or what are other terrible decisions that they made, unqualified judges. Yeah, I'm saying we got to stay on target, and the target is corruption and clawbacks. Not only identify the corruption, find out what it is, and go to work to try to get this money returned to the people it belongs to, and that's the people of the United States. Thank you for that question. But just remember, to choose to do something is to choose to not do something else. And if you do both, which is going to be the answer you're going to get, no, we got to do it. No, if you do one, then do the other. But do corruption first.
Yeah, I agree. You know, our friend Rahm Emanuel kind of downplayed the idea of investigations. You have to prioritize. You can't do everything for sure, but you have to prioritize, and it would be an abdication of responsibility exactly what you're talking about.
Rob said we should focus on corruption. To be fair to him, he called for it. I have to go back and read it, but I brought it up with him, and he was very aggressive on this. But yes, corruption, even at the expense of everything else.
Yeah. James, David in Lawrence, Kansas, who must be delighted that Bill Self is returning as basketball coach. David says Democrats running for, this is picking up on this, should focus their messaging on corruption, affordability, and ill-conceived wars. But how about adding the Trump cuts in cancer research? You know, as we've said all along, there's so much to talk about, so much bad that's happened. But I think the cuts in cancer research, the cuts in NIH, the cuts, you know, what Robert Kennedy is doing in HHS, people are going to die because of that. So I don't want to, I really don't want to have just a busload of issues to talk about. I don't want to have a laundry list. But I think that you've got a point, David. I would add cutting cancer research and cutting NIH funding to that.
So this is my overall observation. People hate the idea of cutting cancer research. They also hate the idea of closing rural hospitals, okay? They also hate the idea of increased co-pays in Medicare. But what you have to do, what's important, is you have to put these things in context. Why would a sane politician cut cancer research, of which affects everybody? Why would I say, and the reason is they need the money for tax cuts for the wealthy, to fight these wars, to do all the terrible things they do. In other words, you have to give people a context and a reason. And it doesn't make sense on the surface that people say, well, why would a politician cut their own research? Because everybody wants to do that. That's not enough. You have to put everything into context. And why would they be doing such a thing? And then you supply the answer. It's very, very important. And the problem is, if you talk about cancer research again, you're not talking about rural hospitals, you're not talking about schools or anything else. So you got to pick your targets, and you also got to identify a reason that this is happening to you.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Our final question is from Phil in Birmingham, Alabama, who I know listens to this show a lot, James, because he knows us. He says, pivoting from politics, I know you both love sports. I would love to hear your thoughts on the heated exchange after the women's semifinal game between Gino Auriemma and Dawn Staley. I know emotions run high in sports, not just among the players. Did Gino go too far?
I love Coach Gino. And he did, and he apologized. And he has is probably one of the great, not women's basketball coaches of all time. He's one of the best coaches of all time. Look at his record. Look what he did.
He may be the best.
He could be. So, yeah. Yes, he went too far. Yes, in his entire career. And Coach, you know, I love you to death. And look, you know, sports can get very heated, and sometimes they get too heated, and you made a mistake and you owned up to the mistake, and it's time just to move on. But I will say something. I thought this year's men's tournament was a dud. I had one game that I really remember, and that was the UConn-Duke game. I couldn't even make it to the end of the championship game. It just wasn't very good basketball. Maybe it was good defense, or maybe there were other things. The semifinal games were not that good. And I love March Madness, but this was one of the all-time uninspiring March Madnesses of all time.
James, I 95% agree with you. I actually thought that final was a good game. I mean, it was really tough. You looked at those guys on the boards. My God, it was tough. They both played with incredible energy and guts. And no, it wasn't a buzzer beater. It wasn't anything. But I thought all the games up to that point, other than Duke UConn, had been really disappointing. But I liked the final. I thought the final was, you know, it was pretty good. And I will say this, in many ways, the women's Final Four was much better than the men's, because in the semifinal, you thought, well, okay, UConn beats South Carolina. No, South Carolina beat them. And going into that final game, I thought South Carolina was a heavy favorite. And it wasn't a good game. It wasn't a close game. But UCLA was just dominant. And that was impressive.
And I was watching a warm-up. UCLA beat us right at the end by one. And I said, these South Carolina, these girls are just, these women, so called girls, these women are really tough. I don't think UCLA is ready for getting ready to happen to them. And I was dead ass wrong.
Yeah, I had the same.
A bet now, and I would have bet everything in the world in South Carolina. I would have been massively wrong. My hat's off to UCLA. And I just think, I've become a bigger fan of the women's basketball games. They move quickly. They're highly, highly competitive. But
oh, God, they are so good. I have to be parochial. One of the stars of UCLA was Kiki Rice, a graduate of Sidwell Friends, which we, up until 10 years ago, no one thought of as a great basketball powerhouse, but it is now. She's a senior. She had a great career at UCLA. And James, the other thing I would note is that right now is the next month is the hottest time in college basketball. It used to be you waited, you know, in the summer and the fall, and you recruited the best high school players. There are going to be 2,000 college players who go on what's called the portal transfer right now. And Michigan built their team on the portal transfer totally. And right now, there are 2,000 players out there. Every one of the North Carolina starters is there. And the bidding war is beginning now. I have problems with some of it. But it's just, the next month is going to decide which teams are going to be really good next year.
Yeah, it's inevitable with basketball's happening, but it's just the truth is the big football schools are determining the fate of other sports and college sports because they generate so much revenue. And I think we got to rethink the whole idea. I mean, we all love the mid-majors and we love the Cinderella stories and stuff like that, but they're becoming increasingly rare, And, you know, sometimes you got to, I think is, money has inevitably been more and more a part of college sports. We got to rethink the levels of competition.
Well, I slightly disagree with you. I do think that the big football schools have some advantages, but they're you know, a number of non-big football schools, UConn, Gonzaga, Duke, St. John's, as much as I hate their coach, that are really competitive. I think having a great coach is going to get you money. And and I think, you know, but it all comes down to money.
Well, but Duke, understand the revenue Duke gets from being in the ACC compared to the revenue that UConn gets for being in, I guess, the Big East or whatever is substantial. And I think what you're starting to see is fewer and fewer of these examples. I mean, UConn, I mean, they have, you know, huge basketball tradition, but it looks like to me it's gone in the direction of more established schools.
Well, I you know, if you're not a UConn or not a Duke or a Gonzaga, I think you're right. But, you know, a great coach can build a great program and a great fan base. And UConn, I'm trying to think pre-Calhoun, 40 years ago, UConn was a nothing, absolute nothing. And then Jim Calhoun and Geno built one of the great, I mean, if there is any school that I would say is the most powerful basketball school in America today, it would be UConn, the men and women's.
And otherwise,
yeah, and you know, that's pretty amazing. I the tournament was disappointing. There were no upsets, James. I mean, there were no upsets in the men's. You know, not a single one. I mean,
they're not Gonzaga. They do have some football revenue. They're a little bit better position at Big State University. You know, it was nothing but the whole Final Four was nothing but for big-time state universities. And I just think that's going to, for better or worse, I'm just saying because of a graduate one, but they're just starting to dominate the sports scene.
Wow. I'm sticking with UConn and Duke, I hope. We'll see. All right, listen, we love those questions, whether it's about sports or about robots and AI or about politics. Keep them coming. If we didn't get to them this week, I promise we'll try to get to it next week. Send in again.
The questions were particularly good this week.
They were really good. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd appreciate it if you'd check out the links to our sponsors, Miracle Made, Delete Me, and Quince, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go and take a look. I even wrote about basketball this week. You can also find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.
What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear: strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/ohio's time.